Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. ProPublica and Frontline reporter A.C. Thompson has been intensely following the rise of white supremacist violence in America for several years now. After the massacre of 11 Jewish worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh, Thompson, like many Americans, found himself asking, where does this hatred come from? Frontline's Documenting Hate, New American Nazis seeks to answer part of that question by exposing the terrorist objectives of the neo-Nazi group Atomwaffen. The documentary airs tonight, 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, on SDPB-TV. Reporter and producer A.C. Thompson joins us now via phone. A.C. Thompson, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So you have a professional reaction to the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue, but also a deeply personal one as an American, as a human, and as someone who's been following this for some time now. Tell me a little bit about that moment when you hear about this shooting and some of the first things that arise in your mind.
You know, the thing that was that struck me is that what was happening there was what I had been hearing about covering the white supremacist movement for many, many months and several years at this point, that these are the types of attacks, the types of terror incidents that are celebrated in that movement, that are exalted in that movement. And so this is a movement that its members see, people like Dylan Roof, the Charleston church shooter, or Tim McVeigh as heroes. And so when that incident happened, I immediately thought, you know, this may well be connected to the broader white power movement.
And you fear there's more to come because of the knowledge that you have and the work that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about where this particular Frontline ProPublica documentary looks at. Let's talk about Atomwaffen.
So the Atomwaffen Division is a relatively new neo-Nazi organization that started in Florida in 2015, and it has since grown to have members spread across the country, as well as members abroad in Canada and Australia and other places. The group is, I would say, at the most extreme end of the current white power revival and the current white power movement. Their aims are to overthrow the government of the United States, ignite a race war, and basically impose a fascist dictatorship on this country. And the way that they think they're going to get there is by engaging in acts of assassination, random violence, and basically guerrilla warfare.
There is this notion that going underground after Charlottesville is a strategic advantage. Large protests maybe are not as effective. How come? What about the riots at Charlottesville and the violence there, and has made them sort of take this other tactic that, you know, we need to be a little more underground?
Hey, so the thing that most people don't understand is that within the white power movement, Charlottesville was seen as an attack on the movement. They saw themselves as the victims. They didn't have a lot of empathy for Heather Heyer, who was murdered. They didn't have a lot of sympathy for the other people who were injured in the car attack there. They felt that their rights to assemble, to rally, to spread their message had been infringed upon. And so some of those people in that movement said, well, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to go out in public and have big public rallies where people can come and oppose us. What they said is, we're going to take a page out of the actions of the earlier white supremacist movement from the 80s and 90s, and we're going to start engaging in acts of leaderless resistance and basically cell-style terrorism, where you have a small group of people or just a single individual who go out and commit spectacular acts that are aimed to both destabilize the government and spread the message of the movement.
I want to talk more about this idea of leaderless resistance, because there's a lot to it in the sense that it becomes difficult then when there is an action to also attach it to a particular group. Talk about the politics and sort of the law enforcement challenges of that.
Right. So if we think about ISIS putting out the message, hey, if you support the Islamic State, go out and commit attacks against the West. Just claim the attacks for us. Say you're part of ISIS and you're doing this for us. It's the same idea that's been disseminated in the white supremacist movement for decades now. You know, if you want to be part of the movement, if you want to do something for the movement, just go out and do it. You don't need anybody's approval. Do it. And so when we see acts like Tim McVeigh's bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building back in 1995, which killed 168 people, I think the typical thing is that people see that and they say, oh, this was one guy. He was kind of crazy, you know, but it doesn't reflect more than that. He's this quote-unquote lone wolf. But the truth is that Tim McVeigh, one, was working with other people who were implicated in that case. That's the first thing. The second thing is that he came out of a movement that supported this type of activity and encouraged it. And that's the same thing that we're seeing today. And I think that what we're seeing with law enforcement is that there's been such a focus on jihadist-style terrorism for the last approximately 20 years that the sort of white supremacist and white power extremists have kind of fallen off the radar of law enforcement. And they don't really know how to respond or how to infiltrate these groups now.
Why is that more difficult for law enforcement? Is it a resources problem? Is it, you know, there's politics involved here? What are the challenges for law enforcement to sort of take that as seriously as, or maybe they are taking it very seriously and it's a resources issue? How do you see that?
You know, I think honestly, you need people with subject matter expertise, right? Yeah. Like any one of these sort of groups and these movements, they have their own culture, they have their own sort of dynamics, they have their own things that propel them and are important to them. And you have to have agents and analysts that know that stuff, that understand it. And then you have to get people inside these groups. And the tactics are constantly evolving. The technologies used to network these groups are evolving. So you need somebody who's both tapped into really like current modes of organizing and communication, and also is very read into this particular subculture. And I think that's the challenge, that when you don't have people focused on this, you can't penetrate these groups. Does that make sense?
It does. And you've been focused on this for some time. And what's first of all, I'm worried about you. And you have these phone numbers and you're talking to people, you're showing up, you show up at a heavy metal concert to try to get an interview with a member of Adam Waffen, who's known as Rape. That's his how he presents himself to the world. And so talk a little bit about your own experience as a journalist and how you're able to get some of the access that you are, and where are you finding closed doors?
You know, I mean, I think honestly, the challenge for any reporter covering this beat is that this is a movement that sees itself as being locked in total war with the media. So nothing is off limits to the movement and the white supremacists in terms of hitting back at what they see as their foes in the media. And that's the thing I think that makes all of us that cover this subject nervous. And I think we've all had unpleasant experiences. But I think honestly, that's a reflection too, more broadly, of this coarsening of the culture, where people spend a large amount of their time online just behaving badly towards one another. You know, I think the massive wave of anti-Semitic harassment that we saw on Twitter in the run-up to the presidential election in 2016 is another reflection of that. A lot of it directed at journalists, but a lot of it just directed at people perceived to be Jewish just because they're perceived to be Jewish. And I think, what I get is sort of the most ugly and extreme sort of end of a sort of wave, I think, of bad behavior in America and, just nastiness.
And the algorithm of social media is really helping them find the next, you know, so if somebody is, you know, maybe mildly racist or they have certain ideas they want to explore, within a day of, you know, sitting there and going through YouTube, they're going to find the connections to a much deeper ideology that that advocates violence. It's easy to go from thinking something to acting on it in today's world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about
absolutely.
This connection.
I think the social media component of it is a thing that people don't are just starting to understand.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about this connection that you deal with, you know, very effectively in this documentary, which is the military and the veteran connection. So it's important to say, you know, it's a statistically insignificant number of veterans who are participating in these organizations. Most people who are participating in white supremacist violence are not veterans or active duty military. And yet the impact of the people who are is outsized. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, and I think you've said it exactly correctly, and I don't want to disparage veterans. My father served in the Army. My grandfather served in the Army, you know, so that's the last thing I want to do. But I also know that my elders would be horrified by the sort of way that this small contingent of former service members has played this big role in the white supremacist movement over decades. So what happens is, for a movement that styles itself as a sort of paramilitary movement that thinks of itself as being at war with the government, the people that you need in that movement are people that actually know how to make war. And that means that the movement ends up recruiting people from the U.S. military to play those sort of roles of organizing the movement, of training in weapons, in preparing sort of plans for attacks on people of color, Jews, and the state. So when you look back, you see people like Louis Beam, who was a key KKK leader who took the Klan towards a paramilitary stance. He had served in Vietnam. You look back at people like Fraser Glenn Miller, who had also served in Vietnam, was a key part of the movement, and then ended up killing three people outside of Jewish institutions in Kansas a few years ago, and is now awaiting the death penalty in prison. That you look at people like Wade Page, who served in the U.S. Army and killed six worshipers at a Sikh temple outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2012. These are the kind of people that have come out of the military and then played these really key roles in the movement, either as leaders or as architects of terror incidents.
So I'm a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, and one of the things, as I see this work, it seems to me that it is, you know, we're always talking in our community about helping people transition to the civilian world, preventing, you know, suicide, and we have a conversation later on the show about efforts veterans are making to reach out to other veterans in all sorts of dire straits. It seems like an important conversation to me to be able to say there are organizations who are going to recruit you because of the skills and training you have. That's not who we are, because clearly the military is very strong against this kind of behavior. And yet it's a delicate thing to talk about. Are you finding that the United States military was open about their efforts? Do you think they're taking it seriously?
You know, I mean, part of my difficulty engaging how seriously the military is taking it is that, you know, nobody really wanted to talk about this with us. What the Pentagon is saying is that, look, we've had 27 reports of domestic extremist activity over the last 5 years. We have disciplined or separated from the service 18 of the people involved in those reports. And so that would suggest that it's a very, very, you know, absolutely microscopic problem, particularly when you compare it to other things that military police, military investigators have to deal with. I am not sure that those are accurate numbers, though. And, you know, a lot of people who follow this subject, a lot of people who have served in the military say, no, we think that the true scope of the problem is a lot larger than that.
Which is, yeah, I think that's a lot of people would agree with that statement. I want to talk about James Mason a little bit, because you find he calls you You find this man who other people in Adam Waffen are using his writings and his inspiration to sort of help them figure out how to develop their own ethos of terrorism, although they don't necessarily see themselves as terrorists, but the actions that they're taking. And you sit down with him, and I want to ask you as a journalist how you made the decisions about, like, what do you put on air that he says, and what do you say, like, no, there's no, I mean, how do you make those decisions about some of this ideology, what really needs to be heard, what Americans need to understand about what he's preaching?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it was a really big debate here at the frontline offices and at the ProPublica offices about what we should use from that interview. And it went through many, many different iterations. And I think we finally pretty much got it right with what we put out. But our general approach is like, hey, we don't need to broadcast racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic propaganda. And we generally don't want to give the microphone to people who are doing that. You know, that's our general approach with doing this kind of reporting. In this case, in the aftermath of the Tree of Life massacre, we felt like we wanted people to hear from this individual for two reasons. For one, to understand that this is a person who believes that some of the worst mass murderers in American history are heroes. So that's the first thing. And that's an important thing to understand. This guy is inspiring a movement that venerates mass murderers. Important to understand. And that movement's active right now. The second thing to understand is, like, yeah, anti-Semitism is here. It is absolutely here. And we don't want to be paranoid and we don't want to be alarmist, but you do need to hear from this guy because he represents what a lot of people in this movement are saying and thinking. And we wanted to say to people again, you know, I could paraphrase this in my narration. I could tell you what he told me, but we wanted you to hear just a little bit from him. And also, you know, write it off, like let people know, like, I don't agree with this. This is ridiculous conspiracy theory, but this is what these people think. And so be vigilant and be prepared.
Yeah, and this is how they are calling out for others to behave, because he is very clear, you know, I don't want to be involved, but by the way, if somebody does something, they're my hero.
Yeah, exactly.
And they hear that, and they hear that message. But for people who, this is going to air on South Dakota Public Television and across the nation, for people who are in South Dakota and are listening and wondering, is this a problem here? Is this something that's going on here? You don't travel to South Dakota in this documentary. You're in Florida. You're in Texas. You're in other places. What about the Midwest?
You know, we definitely came across some people who were involved in this movement, not in South Dakota, but in Minnesota, Wisconsin. I don't think we came across anybody in either North or South Dakota, but let me look in my files. You know, I think a thing that's important to know, that, you know, in some ways right here, we're looking at the really extreme wing of this movement, but we're also talking about a movement whose ideas in many ways, unfortunately, are becoming, you know, many of their ideas are becoming quite widespread and becoming mainstream. And I think that's a thing that we need to be on the lookout for as well, is, you know, we've highlighted the very militant end of this movement, but we also see, like, traces of this penetrating into all corners of American life. So I'm looking at a spreadsheet I have of these guys, and I do not see anybody from your state in there. But, you know, when we built this spreadsheet, it was the beginning of the year, and things could have changed in the last several months.